Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we've got a great show for you tonight. I know I say that every week, but hey, you know, we just have a great time on the show. We have a good crew here. We have a great group of co-hosts that get together, and we're going to be bringing you some timely, up-to-date stuff on a couple of different things going on, and I'll get into that more in a little bit. But first, we can't even consider, I mean, seriously, not consider doing the show until we bring Sam Bradley on. Hey, Sam.
Oh, Jamie, you make me feel so good. And I got to wonder how many dogs are in Dr. Joe's lap at the moment.
All of them.
Very good. Well, first we'll go to Miss Becky DePodwin because it's cold here, Becky. It's dark and cold. And then they tell us it's going to be 68 tomorrow, and then snow on Monday and Tuesday. I'm confused, but then this is Colorado. And I hear Jamie's kind of cold back there in Baltimore as well. So what is going on with the weather?
I mean, kind of a roller coaster, I guess. We're going to experience it here too in the east, but you're going to get it first. So you had the cold, a little bit of snow. What was that, yesterday, the day before yesterday? The first snow I think you've seen all year, if I'm not mistaken. It's been a pretty dry start to the year in Colorado. But then Sunday, I believe, across much of the plains, high plains, is going to be probably near record-setting high temperatures. Like, we're talking high temps in the 70s in parts of, like, Kansas, Oklahoma. Very, very warm, but also very, very windy. And then that's going to kind of translate east. And so we'll get hit with some warm weather on Monday and Tuesday. Practically shorts weather, really, if you count 50s as being able to wear shorts in February, which I certainly do. Yeah, then snow again for you guys, Sam, in Colorado on Monday, Tuesday. Unfortunately for us, Jamie, I think we're going to just miss out completely in the east. There's a storm that we were kind of eyeing. That low is going to stay totally off the East Coast, maybe produce some winds for coastal New England. And I guess maybe some snow for interior parts of the Northeast, maybe Sunday night. But honestly, just nothing exciting going on except for unseasonably warm temperatures, which has kind of been the story for this winter so far.
Well, given that Dr. Joe in Memphis is generally warm, what's it going to be for him this week?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. I think he'll see warmer temperatures as well, probably that Monday timeframe. But otherwise, he's kind of in the middle of not a whole lot going on.
Well, that's better than hearing about a bunch of tornado outbreaks and tsunamis. Oh, by the way, we had like a 7.7 earthquake. Where was that? I can't remember. Becky, you should know.
Yeah, that was North
Caribbean.
There, yeah, about 70, 75 miles northwest of Jamaica, I believe. Or south, I forget. But yeah, apparently it was.
Yeah.
It was felt all the way in like Miami and southern Florida. But a very small tsunami did occur. Like, I think it was less than a foot.
Now, 7.7 is a pretty good earthquake. So depending on where it is and how deep it is and all of those things. Well, we're going to get back to Becky on a related but kind of unrelated weather topic. Well, you guys will figure it out. Anyway, we're going to hit up Dr. Joe because what we haven't talked about yet, and is it a huge issue right now, is coronavirus, which has found its way from China into the U.S. And I, someone had sent a link to me in our community. It's got kind of an interesting title, but I'm sure Jimmy can put it up. But it gives all the current stats. And generally, there was, or at least as of this morning, there was 8,236 cases, most of these, of course, in China, 171 deaths, but 143 people have recovered. So I guess this isn't one of those if you get it, you die things. And so far, they've identified 6 cases in the U.S. So as usual, those people, you know, you just can't stop them when they travel around if they're sick, and then they take it with you. So Dr. Joe, I'm going to let you have it from here.
Well, thanks, Sam. This is a very interesting virus. I think part of the concern with this virus is that it is novel, quote unquote, meaning it is something unique that we have, our immune systems have not seen much of before. So there's very poor immunity in the field, as opposed to things like flu, which tend to have at least some level of immunity to a lot of the flu viruses. So that's part of the issue with this thing. I think it's moving fairly rapidly right now. I've been talking to my colleagues from around the country and the world, actually, in the last few days about this thing. And, there was a case in Washington State that was actually a patient who was screened when they arrived and, apart from a travel history, didn't have anything else, but no fever, none of that kind of stuff. And then the next day got sick. So that's, one of the real challenges of trying to keep tabs on this thing is that despite our screening, sometimes they're still in the incubation period and there's nothing to find until late. And then just, I think, day before yesterday, I heard, I was talking with some friends from Europe, and they actually were telling me about a case in Central Europe that was four or five local folks tested positive for the virus with no travel history at all. Their only contact was through a visitor from China to their offices. And so now they're all positive and doing well, as far as I know. But it's going to be a very, very difficult virus to get our arms around and try to maintain any control over, because it appears now that it spreads person to person as well as from the original sources in China.
Jamie.
Yeah, Joe, just kind of give us a rundown. I mean, my understanding is that the vast majority of people that seem to get this probably have minor cold-like symptoms. Only a relatively few number, percentage-wise, actually progress to getting more serious cases. Is that correct?
That is what I understand currently, although I think part of what's a little bit different about this virus is that the sort of typical upper respiratory and early flu-like symptoms are pretty mild, a little fever, a little aches, but it appears to be much more, aggressive is the right word, in the lower airways, in the lungs. And so, when folks begin to get sick, they begin to get really sick without an awful lot of prodrome of upper respiratory stuff, that precedes it.
Well, Joe, what are they saying about the potential in this country? And I'm sure that discussion has occurred among docs as far as this thing catching hold in a bigger way.
Well, I don't think we know the answer to that yet. Certainly there's an awful lot of surveillance going on in an effort to try to stay ahead of this thing a little bit. It's my understanding that multiple places around the world now have access to the DNA sequence and all that sort of stuff of this virus so that they can work on treatments and vaccines, et cetera. But I think right now we're just in a very aggressive monitoring mode. And then when we do identify something, attempting to isolate those folks and prevent further spread.
Becky, you have a question.
Yeah, Joe, what are your thoughts on the plane that was commissioned to take Americans from China to the United States, and then the fact that it stopped over in Anchorage? Obviously, I'm sure the CDC sent people to Anchorage, but is that a can that actually appropriately screen people in Anchorage, Alaska? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's a great point. I appreciate the sort of political motivations behind pulling those people out of there. And I do not know enough about the Chinese healthcare system to know, how challenging it is to get access and all that sort of stuff for someone who's not, at home in China. But yeah, I think that the issue is a lot of folks that potentially have significant exposure just a few days in and may well have all screened negative in Anchorage. And then, 2 days from now, wherever they end up, although I think they're being monitored someplace, to see if they begin to develop symptoms. So I think they'll be watching those folks for several days to ensure that they were just not early in the incubation period. I did hear a little blurb on the news tonight about someone who, quote unquote, was trying to leave the I'm not sure the right word here, the containment place that they were being held. That sounds probably a lot more prison-like than is necessary. But, somebody was basically deciding, I don't need to stay here, I'm going to leave. And, of course, I'm sure that'll be the person that turns out to have the virus and spreads it all over the place, wherever they are. But let's hope that people are smart enough to at least be patient and try to give themselves a little time to prove that they don't have it. And not spread it to the rest of us.
Yeah, that movie will be out next year. Jamie, comment?
I know that my wife has a work colleague who had been in China on some business, came back last week, and she's been working from home in her spare bedroom, and her husband brings her food and drinks and sets them outside the door for her. And so that she's trying not to, in case she has it, infect the family. And she says she's told by her family doc to wait like 14 days. Does that sound about right to you, Joe, or is that an overkill?
Yeah, well, I think that the current thought is the incubation period is from 10 to 14 days. I am not privy to, how accurate that information is. But I think that's probably a reasonable guess, based on the stuff I've been reading. So, it may well take 2 hours of, 2 weeks of, quarantine, as it were, to be sure that you don't actually have the virus.
And what is this just, typical precautions otherwise, wash your hands, hand sanitizer, cough into your elbow, all that stuff?
Yeah, it really is droplet precautions and sort of standard PPE stuff. It certainly sounds like this virus is somewhat virulent, meaning it's easy to transmit it doesn't take an awful lot of virus to result in illness. I think anything we can do to protect ourselves in the fairly typical ways is probably as valuable as anything at this point. And that's certainly good hand washing and good respiratory protection with a mask and that sort of stuff. Whenever you're handling patients that have any sort of flu-like illness at all, cough, the usual kind of things that we would think of.
Becky, go ahead.
Any concerns? I mean, I guess you personally and people you are friends with, would you have any concerns with them traveling over the next couple of weeks, months even?
Are you talking about people that are ill currently, or I'm not sure?
Well, no, I'm just a healthy person since.
Oh, just anyone. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. As a matter of fact, my wife and daughter are traveling tomorrow. Thankfully, not to an intake city, meaning a city that gets direct flights out of China, although I think most of those have stopped now. Yes, I suppose the risk is a little bit higher than it might be otherwise. I'm hopeful that standard precautions are going to be enough to keep this thing at bay, and that we'll understand the disease process better and better over the next couple of weeks as the information begins to flow out about the virus itself and best treatments and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it sounds like we're putting the whole country in isolation. So you can imagine to some extent it's going to disrupt a lot of business where they have travel to and from China. But Becky, from your emergency preparedness perspective, do you think there's going to be, and Joe too, and Jamie for that matter, is there going to be a panic behind this, or have we gotten wiser in, you know, how to manage these things?
I mean, I think there's already been a little bit of a panic. I've seen multiple reports of masks being sold out in places and other shortages in hospitals and people taking them from hospitals. So unfortunately, I think the media hasn't done us any favors in sort of blowing this out of proportion to an extent, when there's just so little that's known right now. I did see today that the first human-to-human spread occurred. So that's, I mean, it's concerning. And I don't know. Actually, I don't think I have a good answer. Just that I've already seen very low levels of panic begin to kind of creep up.
Yeah, so education's a good thing. Jamie?
And to get on that, if you go to cdc.gov, it is the top banner on the website to go to the coronavirus main site for the CDC. There is a situational summary at the very top of the page. It shows cases by state in the top of the page. There's information for travelers links there, as well as information for healthcare professionals and laboratories. So, you know, I think all of us that listen to this show will find some good up-to-date information there so that we can pass on the best information possible and try to keep that panic under control.
Joe, on a slightly different note, but not, our friend Christopher Chapman from the UK, he actually deals with working on outbreak plans and so forth. And he was actually referring to the measles epidemic that we had recently. But, you know, he made a point that epidemiology is one of those topics that emergency managers need to be aware of and understanding different types of epidemics and how to deal with them and be prepared for them. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with that completely. You know, that it's an important branch of science that those folks need to understand fairly well, because there are a lot of subtleties there. And, you know, there's some pretty significant decisions that have to be made and some lead time that's necessary in many cases in order to be in the spot you want to be when things really start going south. So here's an example. Just this week, I've had several meetings with my dispatch agencies at all the EMS services that I work with. And we've been talking about at what point should we initiate our surveillance tool on the call-taking side, which is basically just a tool that asks a few focused questions in an effort to attempt to identify potentially high-risk patients. But, you know, it's not just as easy as flipping a switch. We have a large number of telephone operators that have to be trained in how to use it and the right way to ask the questions and what it is that we're looking for. And then, you know, at the same time, it's extra work. It lengthens the call. It's several more questions that have to be asked. And in systems that are already under great stress for responding to emergencies, the last thing you want to do is take another 30 seconds on every call, especially when the yield is likely to be very low. So I think it's not only about getting your tools ready to go and training your people, which takes some time, but also deciding when does it make sense to take on the additional burden of such a tool for the information that you're going to get back. So, you know, I think cities that like Los Angeles and New York probably, and, you know, places that had received flights from mainland China and have known cases in the area, then yes, it completely makes sense for those folks to begin heightening their screening. for Omaha, Nebraska, I don't know if it makes sense to initiate that tool yet. There's nowhere close. Nobody from Wuhan, China is going to show up there without having come through some other locale where they got screened already. So, you know, there's an awful lot of decisions that have to be made, and the timing of those decisions is very important. And as with all things, there is a cost. There's a cost in time. There's a cost in manpower and training and delaying other 911 calls to ask, you know, a whole bunch of questions about travel and symptomatology and all that sort of stuff, when all you're going to do is figure out a whole bunch of people got the flu, which we already do.
Well, and a good point you've made, I don't know how many times over the last 7 years, all first responders especially should be cognizant of respiratory communication and wear your PPE all the time. So regardless of whether it's the flu or the measles or coronavirus or whatever else, they should be protected from it. True?
I agree completely. Yeah, at this point, you know, just good old standard respiratory protection and hand washing appear to be enough. And it's sort of all we got until we know better. So I think the wise folks are certainly taking precautions like that seriously. I know Jamie mentioned, the measles outbreak, or it was mentioned a few minutes ago about the measles outbreak. You know, I view that a little bit differently. That is a completely preventable outbreak. If people were vaccinated, we wouldn't have to worry about measles outbreaks. But viruses like this, we don't yet have a vaccine for, so we have a whole different set of issues to deal with.
Well, that's a perfect segue to my last question on this, because Chris mentioned that the UK used to be a measles-free country, but it no longer is, because there's this growing anti-vax movement. Now, we're really flipping ahead on coronavirus in terms of there even being a vaccine, but that's something we never really talked about. People that have issues vaccinating their kids and they have diseases that we thought were eradicated. What is your take on all of that?
Well, I think you said it beautifully. You know, the most effective thing that medicine has ever done in its entire history is the creation of vaccines. And the anti-vaxxer movement, I'm afraid, is full of bad information and misleading statements. And I think it's unfortunate that many folks are going to, particularly children, are going to suffer because of inaccurate information and inaccurate facts.
Jamie, thoughts to wrap up this segment?
I just would stress again, keep an eye out on the World Health Organization site, and here in the U.S., the CDC. In these situations, the CDC is very good about doing daily updates to that page, and more frequently, if necessary, they will be updating those sections of the page. If you're a healthcare professional that's working in a clinical setting, there is some really good information there on PPE, on what to look for. And all that is right there on the page, and they make it easy for you to, there's even downloadable PDFs you can get and hand out to your staff if you're in a supervisory position. So, take advantage of these resources. That's what they're there for. And make yourself educated so that we can keep people informed appropriately so that they don't make poor decisions. If it seems to be all right to travel for the most part right now, so do what you need to do. Be aware, take reasonable precautions, and keep track of what's going on.
Very good point. Well, we'll give Dr. Joe a break here, and we're going to see the other side of meteorologist Becky Podwin, D. Podwin. And, you know, you've really been studying emergency management, and I don't know anybody that's gone to as many conferences as you have, most of them weather-related, but you know, you have that interesting mix of weather and disaster preparedness and how they all work together. So you were recently at a conference and probably several more. So we'd like to hear what you do there, what you learn there. What are some of the new things that we'd like to hear about?
Yeah, definitely. So the big conference was the annual meeting of the American Meteorological Society. It meets every January. This was the centennial celebration, so it's been around for 100 years now, and it was a very big conference, close to 6,000 people, which may not seem like it's big, but that's big for weather. And it was held in Boston, and you know, it's a pretty academic conference, so there's a lot of interesting research going on. But I'm much more interested in kind of the operational aspect of things and the emergency management aspect. And there were several sessions on both of those things. Are you guys familiar with the term IDSS?
Not really.
So it's information decision. I'm probably gonna get this totally wrong. Decision support services, and it's for the NWS, and it sort of is changing how they interface with emergency managers in their regions of their warning forecast offices. And so there's a lot of work that's been done in probably the past decade or so on messaging and being that decision support for emergency managers in major weather disasters, but also, you know, even more minor events. And so it's having a meteorologist on site in the EOC, you know, providing very up to the minute reports, updated forecasts. This was critical during Hurricane Michael. One of my good friends was actually stationed from the National Weather Service Tallahassee office. He was stationed in the EOC somewhere in Bay County. And having him there was just crucial, particularly after the storm had hit, and helping them understand when it was safe to go out, when it was safe to start, you know, going to try and search for people, doing rescue, things like that. So it's, we're really moving into the era, I think, of meteorologists being not so much forecasters, because a lot of the forecasts are now being automated, but finding that extra value add and what can we do to better communicate the forecast, to adjust the messaging, to help people make these really, really high stake decisions when it comes to impacting, you know, lives, maximizing profit, things like that. And there's a lot being done on the private sector side of that as well, as I'm obviously very familiar with. So there's actually a really interesting panel session that was called Red Skies in the Morning, How Emergency Managers Leverage Weather Data. And we had a National Weather Service MIC, which is meteorologist in charge. We had the administrator from FEMA Region 1, which was pretty cool. We were in Boston, so that made a lot of sense. He was local. A local emergency manager from New Hampshire, the emergency manager from Walmart, and then my boss, actually, who works on our business-to-business side at AccuWeather. And they really talked about what's important to emergency managers in these various settings. And so for Walmart, it's getting that heads up notice that an event is going to be happening in 3 to 5 days time, so they can stage resources and make sure that they're ready to go whenever the event does begin to occur. Transportation and power are a big concern for emergency managers. They want to make sure they can try and keep the power on and obviously keep transportation flowing, whether that's the roadways or trains, transit, things like that. They often plan for low probability but very high impact events, which I think you guys are probably fairly familiar with that concept, is that you plan for the absolute worst that's very unlikely to happen. But if it does, you're going to be very glad that you did plan for it. I mean, that's just kind of a small sort of sampling of some of the talk that's going on with emergency managers. Oh, one more comment. A question was asked in the audience. Do any of these emergency managers sitting up here, you know, ranging from a local EM all the way up to FEMA, you know, administrator, do they use the winter storm names given by the Weather Channel? And every single one of them said no, because it just adds to confusion when they're trying to message to the public. They care much more about the impacts and feel like that sort of media angle of it gets in the way of the messaging.
So Jamie's got a question, but Joe, you can totally appreciate this being on an incident command team for FEMA. Would you like to have a meteorologist go along?
Well, I think there's a lot of value there. You know, we certainly have incoming weather data all the time as part of our situational awareness team. And that's everything from mapping, et cetera. So I don't know that there's necessarily value in having the meteorologist on site, because I would appreciate, I would think that the meteorologist would need some tools that are not likely to be very available in the field. But certainly an open and quick communication line from someone who is at least regional, so that they can provide weather data on a fairly small scale, knowing that, you know, a tornado warning is in a certain area and that sort of stuff, and not having too many layers to pass through before it got to the guys in the field so that we could act on it.
So, Becky, I guess you don't have to slog through the floodwaters with Joe, so that's maybe a good thing. Jamie.
Yeah, and Becky, I just kind of out of curiosity, you know, kind of following up on what Joe said, what do you see as the opportunity for the local meteorologists or to team up with the disaster teams that are coming in or and doing some training ahead of time? How much do they need to understand the incident command system and all the things that go on, understanding the different layers that go on in a disaster response?
That's a good question. I don't think there's much responsibility to shoulder as far as the meteorologists that are in that local area. I think a lot of it's going to be on the local emergency managers to have, you know, decent protocol and organizational procedures set up so they can easily pass that on to, you know, teams that are coming in from outside. I think that's also where that clear line of communication comes into play, and making sure that, you know, the meteorologists know who their point of contact is, and that point of contact knows who to then send the message on to. I think, of course, ensuring you don't have too many loops in there, you're not playing telephone and getting the message muddled. That's a good question. I would imagine that that may not be set up as well as would be ideal in a lot of situations. And then maybe that's something that's figured out, you know, as a disaster is ongoing or after it happens during an after action report.
That is a good question. I really never thought about their level of knowledge within ICS and disaster preparedness. So what are some of the other conferences you go to, Becky, and what do you learn there that may be different than this one?
Ooh. So my involvement in AMS is I do a lot of sort of mentoring. So that's kind of my main role within AMS, besides obviously representing my company, is to, you know, I sit on the board for early career professionals, and we try and keep people involved and make sure they know the resources. Otherwise, AMS is a fairly academic heavy organization. So it's a lot of research, which I don't do a lot of because I'm not in academia. There is also the National Weather Association meeting, which occurs in the fall. And that is very much geared towards operational forecasting. So you get even more of the IDSS, that hands-on support. We heard a lot about hurricane support and forecasting this last fall. A lot of stories to come out of Michael and Florence. Those are the two big ones. I went to a climate workshop last June, and we talked about a lot of the sort of climate resiliency work that's being done in coastal locations and how they're preparing those communities for sea level rise, which was very interesting and very different. It's all sorts of ones. There was a workshop in July about bridging the gap between the current meteorology curriculum and the private sector and what may be missing as far as like the skills and the knowledge that the students are coming out of college with. Just a handful. I think, Jamie, you have a question?
Yes,
yeah, I actually do. The question I have is, you talked about mentoring the new students, the newer meteorologists coming out into the career path, and I'm curious, because you have a background and your degree in emergency management, how aware are they coming out of college of the impact on emergency planning and things like that that a meteorologist can have on a community? Because some of these people are going to go into like small local radio weather or radio or TV markets. They might go into local planning markets. And do they understand how important that messaging stuff is?
The answer is no, but that is changing. When I graduated from college a decade ago, I had zero idea. I knew nothing about this. And it's just sort of been, as I've, gone in the field and just gained experience and figured out what I wanted to do and started to talk to so many different people, that's how I've realized how much need there is for meteorologists to be in these, in EOCs, in the private sector, really helping with the disaster messaging. And so it's interesting when I talk to students and talk about my career path and what I do, you can sort of see this light bulb go on when they realize the range of possibilities that this opens up. And I don't think the jobs are all there right now, but I think they're going to be in the next 5, 10, 15 years. I think people are, and by people, I mean, businesses, things like that, are starting to realize the benefits of having someone with the knowledge of weather and also with that more specific knowledge of how to plan for weather on their team. And it's knowing your risks, understanding the vulnerabilities, which may seem like a daunting thing, but it's really not. I don't think it's that difficult to do a risk and vulnerability assessment and then come up with a plan. And so if students can come out with, and we're starting to see a bit more of these kind of dual programs, so a major in meteorology and a minor in emergency management. But that's not even totally necessary. It's just having that, the weather knowledge, and then having the ability to communicate it in a way that people can take action on. And so having that component is really important.
And I think that it's interesting because the companies can really benefit from that. I mean, I look at the companies that have emergency plans for climate change over the next 10 to 20 years, because they have properties that are going to be impacted by sea level rise or by increased weather activity because of increasingly, increasingly active weather patterns. All of these things, affect their travel planning, their workforce planning. And so I totally agree with you that major corporations are going to have some handle on this to plan effectively for their capital investment and everything else over the next 10 to 20 years.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a growing part of the field, and it's only going to continue to expand as disasters become more frequent and worse. And we've already seen that happen in the past, 5-10 years with the hurricanes that we've had and the flooding. And yeah, it's a good point.
Wow. Yeah. So Joe, when you're doing training with Paragon and you might have a setup, because it's all experiential, and you have a setup where there may be an EOC, I don't know that you've actually done that, but has what's your sense of people adopting this idea of having meteorologists not necessarily there, but certainly engaged?
Well, I think it's very forward thinking, and my guess is going to be it's much more the experienced people that are going to really appreciate the level of expertise and knowledge that somebody like that could bring into the planning and the operation, the field operation itself. So I think part of the challenge now is to make certain that that's a bit more incorporated into the basic training stuff and have people thinking along those lines earlier on in their career. I think Becky's right. This is a growth area for sure. And we're just learning to appreciate what the contribution is there.
Well, I'm glad to see it happening. It makes perfect sense. Any thoughts from you, Jamie?
No, I think this has been a great discussion, and I know that this sprang from for me and others in our group, watching Becky posting about her trip to this recent conference and some of the panels that she was, that she talked about earlier, that just seemed fascinating. And it's nice to see, you know, disaster planning kind of branching out into more areas and bringing in more buy-in, because I think all of these things, you know, Becky, maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, how this adds to the resiliency of the community, because that planning and preparedness angle can be impacted by accurate weather forecasting and good messaging.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you have that heads up, you know, even 3 days, 5 days is even better, that a storm is going to impact the area, you can stage those resources, have them ready to go. We sort of saw this in Katrina, where resources were kind of half staged and things got kind of messed up there. But here's also where the balance of the private sector and the public sector comes into play, is if a private sector is contracted out at a certain organization or a facility, say a manufacturing plant, and the local emergency manager knows that that manufacturing plant has a private sector weather service who is going to be providing them with warnings, who has helped them stand up an emergency action plan, that gives that emergency manager peace of mind to know that that's maybe one less thing that they need to focus as, you know, that they need to focus as closely on. And so there's so much work and there's so much that we can all do. But it's a really good example of that public-private partnership, which we do see a lot of at these conferences, is where we really come together as an enterprise and realize the different things that we all bring to the table, and how we can all benefit and how ultimately the public benefits when we work together.
There's that interoperability word again. It hasn't been spoken, but it's there. So any final thoughts, Joe?
Well, I think we've covered a lot of territory here, and I think a lot of it is touching on the leading edges of a lot of things that we're going to see more of in our future. Certainly the ability to better understand pandemics and the threat of emerging infectious diseases, as well as the challenges associated with longer range and higher quality weather predictions, so that we can plan better for what to expect and when we can expect it to happen. So I think this is a bit of a glimpse into the future. So happy 2020.
And for that reason, Becky, I think we want to have this conversation more than once, especially as things begin to change and develop, because it's good information. And I love that communication between meteorology and disaster preparedness, because it makes perfect sense. Any final thoughts from you?
Just that we didn't even get into the mental health aspect of disaster response, of which there were several panels out at AMS. So maybe a future episode.
You know what? I would love to do a whole episode on that. So maybe we can plan that, because I think that's a topic that needs its own spot. And yeah, let's plan on that.
Awesome. I know some people that would be good guests or a guest.
There you go. Yeah, I'll touch base with you on that. So, Jamie, I'm going to throw it at you for closing here.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned Joe and Paragon Medical Education Group and the you know, the amazing experiential training that they do and how forward thinking they've been and continue to be. Joe, you all just really set the bar that I haven't really seen too many other, if any, organizations meet. How do you do it? How do you continually outperform expectations for your clients when they bring you in to do these types of special training sessions?
Well, thanks, Jamie. I certainly appreciate that. You know, I think it's part of our efforts to stay ahead of the curve and try to present folks with the latest knowledge, science, and ideas that are relevant to our field. And an appreciation that our field continues to get broader and broader and broader, and the skill set required to be a high functioner in that environment it continues to grow. So, you know, we would certainly ask anybody that would like to step their game up another level to reach out and contact us. They can do that at Paragon Medical Education Group or Paragon Medical Group on the web or on Facebook at the same name. And you can always reach us to the Disaster Podcast.
Well, thank you, Joe. And I urge people to do that. And we talk about it every week on the show. But, you guys just aren't our sponsors. This is part of the team here. And we believe in the research you do and the incredible training evolutions you all come up with. So we urge the listeners out there to just, you know, it's a phone call and you'll be surprised at how affordable it can be for your system and how they can bring in something just truly groundbreaking and game changing for your teams. So Becky, where can folks find you if they want to follow what you go to on the next conference you're at?
Yeah, definitely. I'm on Twitter at WX_Becks, BECKS. And I'm always available and around on the Disaster Podcast Facebook group.
And Sam, how about you?
Well, those places. Also on Facebook under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 in our Disaster Podcast group on Facebook, which is ever growing. And certainly on disasterpodcast.com. Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most places out there on social media. So please friend or follow me there. And of course, disasterpodcast.com and on our Disaster Podcast group on Facebook. Just search for Disaster Podcast, ask to join the group. We'd love to have you in there. There's always active discussions. We mentioned it here on this show that people are posting stuff about the coronavirus and vaccines and all sorts of things. We post all the episodes there and there's great conversations and most of our guests become members of the group as well. So all the expertise we bring to bear here on the show pretty much shows up in the podcast group as well. And there's just a tremendous amount of, hundreds of years of accumulated experience there in that group, which is pretty, pretty fascinating when you think about it.
Well, and it shows we have so much expertise within our little family here, too, and that's always something I enjoy. But I guess, you know, there's a lot of things we could say about tonight's episode. But in general, we'll say disaster weather is not our everyday weather.